This is the story of a book hidden for centuries in the shadows of history.
Gosh, here it is.
An unknown jewel of the English canon, and the first book ever written by a woman, Julian of Norwich.
What a book. You know, what an accomplished and magnificent and sophisticated book.
Revelations of Divine Love, written in 1373, dared to present an alternative vision of man's relationship with God.
She's blazing a trail. She's doing something quite unprecedented.
A theology fundamentally at odds with the church of her time.
You wanted to prevent yourself going to hell.
Hidden away for 500 years, the book re-emerged as an iconic text for the women's movement.
Look at this!
May I undo it?
Please!
And is now acknowledged as a classic.
It's one of the first great masterpieces of English prose.
This is the incredible story of the survival of Julian's book.
We're not going to open it.
And the brave women who championed it.
We would not have Julian without you and your community.
Julian of Norwich, The Search for the Lost Manuscript. Yanina's getting her children ready to go out.
Squeeze!
I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez, mother of two, an Oxford academic, with a passion for all things medieval.
Let's get this on. So this is the story of a book, The Revelations of Divine Love. For me, I first encountered it when I was an undergraduate studying Middle English at St. Anne's College, Oxford. It's captured me ever since.
This is an impressive book. It's the expression of a brilliant mind and feels as relevant and fresh today as it did when it was written over 600 years ago in 1373 by Julian of Norwich, who was a woman.
Right, all ready for school?
Yeah!
Come on then, let's get you out of the car.
This was a time when most women's lives were confined to the domestic sphere.
Bye.
Very few women had access to an education. It would be another 500 years before women were allowed to study here at Oxford. In medieval England, almost all intellectual thought was framed by the church and written in Latin by men. Women were certainly not encouraged to think or speak about God. But speak or write, Julian did. In English, the language of ordinary people.
Yanina's parking her bicycle.
Her vision of an unconditionally loving God was fundamentally at odds with a church that believed in eternal damnation. In fact, for Julian and those who read her book, it was potentially life-threatening. I'm starting my exploration of Julian's text by reliving a bit of my own history. I studied medieval literature here at Oxford University. My first tutor is now the J.R.R. Tolkien Professor of English, Vincent Gillespie.
So Vincent, I first fell in love with Julian in your classes at the age of 18, learning English literature with you.
It's one of the first great masterpieces of English prose, and the first great masterpiece of English prose written by a woman.
So can you read me a little bit of Julian then?
Yes, of course. And these words, "Thou shalt not be overcome," were sighed full sharply and full michtily for sickness and comfort against all tribulations that might come in. He sighed not, "Thou shalt not be tempested, thou shalt not be travailed, thou shalt not be diseased," but he sighed, "Thou shalt not be overcome."
We know some big names that are coming from around the time of Julian, people like Chaucer. Does she stand up to being read alongside such a great author?
That's a big challenge, isn't it? It's a big ask. But I think in terms of the sheer beauty of her prose, there's nobody else at that period who I think can really challenge her.
On a train?
Some scholars have said that if Chaucer is the father of English poetry, then Julian is the mother of English prose. But Chaucer was widely known and read in his own time, while Julian and her book Revelations of Divine Love were cast into oblivion.
What I find incredible is that this amazing little book survives at all. That it does is nothing short of a miracle. Almost nothing is known about Julian herself, and her text remains unread. It was sidelined, repressed, vilified, and forgotten down the centuries. But it was also kept secret, treasured, guarded, and defended by a series of women.
Pilgrims, nuns, and suffragettes have all played a part. The story of the survival of this book is an extraordinary one. After all, Julian's text proposes an optimistic theology in which God promises her that all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. To understand why Julian's book was so challenging, I'm meeting former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams.
If you think, you know, she's the first serious woman writer in the English language, certainly the first woman writer to write like that about the things of God. So she's blazing a trail. She's doing something quite unprecedented.
Would you consider Julian to be a radical theologian?
In a sense, she's a very radical theologian because she thinks things through in first principles. It's the time of the burnings of heretics and the Black Death and, you know, all those grim aspects of the 14th century. And in that world, she's not turning away from the reality of suffering. Not at all. And when she writes about the promise that all things will be well, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, I don't think the reader feels that it's a bit of, you know, empty optimism. It's all going to be all right in the end. It's just this steady gaze of God looking at her and saying, trust me, I will bring it all together. And one of the marks of her real genius as a writer is that she is able to present that in sequence, to sort it out into not a system, but a kind of story.
Archbishop of Canterbury, 2002 to 2012.
Julian's own story started here, in Norwich. Her book gives few autobiographical details, but during her lifetime, Norwich was the second city of England, a busy, prosperous, mercantile metropolis. Today, much of the medieval past is still easily visible. In the castle, the cathedral, the city wall, and over 30 medieval churches.
This modern bridge is named after Julian, and the River Wensum was actually the secret of Norwich's success during her lifetime. The Hundred Years' War was raging on the continent, and the coastal ports along the south were vulnerable to attack. But Norwich was further upriver, which meant it was safer. So people could come in here, trade in goods and ideas.
Into this cosmopolitan city, Julian was born in 1343, most probably into a reasonably affluent merchant's family.
You can imagine the vibrancy of the medieval market when Julian came here shopping. There had been lords, artisans, peasants, alongside priests and friars. And then there had been all the languages you'd have heard. English for the common people, French for the aristocracy, Latin for the church, some German, some Flemish, and perhaps even a spattering of Italian.
But even though literacy rates were growing at this time, probably only 20% of men would be able to read English. For women, the rate would be much lower.
But it would have also have been crowded and smelly, with slops and offal running in trenches down the middle of the street. When Julian was just a young girl, 6 years old, plague swept through the city. Lying in her bed, she'd have heard the death carts rumbling through the alleys and smelt the bodies piling into unmarked pits. With accidents and epidemics around every corner, life was tenuous, so it was no wonder that people were turning to religion for the promise of an eternal life.
An archway.
In the 14th century, religious and secular life were totally intertwined. The church year, with its fasts and festivals, was as much a part of daily life as fetching water from a well.
Above the cathedral, with its courtyard and spire dominating the skyline.
We can assume that Julian and her family would have gone regularly to church, and for special celebrations, they'd have visited the great cathedral.
It's amazing to think that Julian would have stood here. She'd certainly have come to the cathedral and would have gone through these doors during big celebrations like Easter, when all of the city would flock here. Little did she know, 700 years later, her own statue would be up here. She's looking out from the doors of Norwich Cathedral.
Julian holding her book. Swinging the metal censer, the celebrant leads the procession, the bishop with his crozier.
The church in Julian's time was presided over by a feared and unpopular bishop, Henry de Spencer, known as the Fighting Bishop. To find out more about him and his church, I'm meeting with the current Bishop of Norwich, Graham James.
So tell me a bit more about what the traditional church would have been like at the time that Julian lived.
Well, it would have felt an extremely powerful and, I think, judgmental body. I mean, my predecessor then, Henry de Spencer, saw himself, of course, as God's servant, but also the king's servant. He was willing to go into battle. He would put down, as he did, the peasants' revolt. He would be perfectly content to see Lollards put to death because they were protesting against the character of the church of the time.
And hell, it was a reality, wasn't it, for most people in the medieval period?
Yes, they feared it. They saw images of it. I mean, this cathedral would have been full of paintings of hell. Every church was. You wanted to prevent yourself going to hell. And hell was a place of terrible and eternal torture. And remember, these were often people who experienced a great deal of pain in their earthly lives. So the thought of that pain being intensified forever was something you wanted to avoid.
It was Bishop Henry de Spencer who commissioned this decorative panel to commemorate the suppression of the peasants' revolt.
I suppose the thing to remember when looking at things like this, they're there to help people understand
yeah.
the big themes of Christianity, aren't they?
These would have been the magazines, the newspapers, you know, the websites. This is what all this was of the day.
Okay, you're so right. And again, what's remarkable is that this dates from Julian's lifetime.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is the sort of imagery she would have seen.
She would have seen it all the time. And of course, the churches at the time were absolutely full of this.
A cobbled street.
As a young woman, Julian could be in no doubt that defying the power of the church led to death in this life and eternal hellfire in the ever after.
Janina walking on.
This thatched building dates back to at least 1420, so it gives us some idea of the sort of house where Julian could have lived. It's now the Britain's Arms Cafe.
But where did women fit into this picture of medieval life? Well, for most ordinary 14th century women, their lives revolved around the domestic sphere. They received very little education, and most girls were married by the time they were 15. We know very little about Julian's early life. We can assume that she followed the general custom, married, and perhaps even had children. When she was just 19, the plague came to Norwich again, and it was in a form that was particularly virulent to children. Perhaps she lost a husband and children in this plague.
From her writing, it seems likely that Julian was a devout layperson who was familiar with death and sorrow. I'm making my way up to the attic room, which may have been used as a bedroom. Julian describes herself as an unlettered creature, but even if she could read English, she'd be unlikely to have access to anything more than a prayer book. The majority of books were written in Latin and expensive. Even the very wealthy probably had 25 books at the most.
This really is an atmospheric space. Look at those amazing medieval beams. And you can even see the wattle and daub that's gone into making the walls. There are these incredible Baltic pine floorboards. They date to 1402. I could really imagine her being in a room like this.
She gazes around the atmospheric space with its framework beams.
When Julian was 30 years old, she herself became ill and nearly died. For 3 days, she lay prostrate, and on the fourth day, she was given the last rites. But she lingered on, with paralysis creeping up her body. A priest was called, and he brought with him a crucifix, which he held up before her eyes as the darkness came closer.
Janina looks out of a leaded window.
Julian entered into a visionary state where the crucifix became living and real. She had a series of mystical revelations in which God spoke directly to her, a simple woman. She now had a direct bodily experience of the divine.
An illustration of the priest holding a crucifix over Julian in her sickbed. Statues on an imposing facade.
I'm really excited. I'm going behind the scenes at the British Museum to a place I haven't been before. I'm going to see a crucifix which may have been the type that Julian actually gazed on as she thought she was dying.
A man in blue gloves lays an artifact on a table for Janina to examine.
Well, we've got a lovely example here of a 15th century figure of Christ. The cross has been lost, and his arms originally would have come upwards at quite a sharp angle. And quite a lot of care has been taken to paint on these very gory, dripping bits of blood. The crucifixion itself wasn't necessarily a bloody act. Most people that are crucified suffocate from the pressure of their bodies pulling down on the cross. But in the 15th century, there's an increasing elaboration on the blood that came out during the crucifixion. I can really picture the scene in Julian's sick room. She's ill, she thinks she's about to die, and the priest holds a crucifix up in front of her. And she sees a vision of pain, of suffering. She says, "And in this suddenly I saw the red blood trickle down from under the garland, hot and freshly, plenteously and lively." She is describing this hot blood, this pain. And it's amazing to be in the presence of an object that would have inspired her.
But Julian didn't die. Over the next day and night, she had 16 visions or revelations.
It's quite moving, seeing that crucifix. It actually really helps me to make sense of her revelations. It's also amazing to think that after she saw that, her life changed completely.
Janina pushes open a security gate, then leaves the museum. An aerial view of Norwich with its places of worship, St Julian's Alley.
As a mystic, Julian now had a direct relationship with God, unmediated by the church. She made a drastic decision. She became an anchoress. An anchoress was a female religious hermit who devoted her life to God by living as a solitary, walled up in just one small room. Julian spent the rest of her life in a cell attached to St. Julian's Church in Norwich. She may even have taken the name of the church.
Wow, look at this place. It's amazing.
The original church was bombed in the Second World War, but has since been restored.
It's incredible to think that on this spot, Julian would have taken her anchoritic vows of poverty, chastity, and stability of abode. She was essentially dying to the world. And as she'd have sat here during those rites, it would be like being a witness at your own funeral. It's also incredible to think that once she went inside this room, she wasn't to come out again for the rest of her life.
Mother Julian's cell on the site of the original anchor hold. Prayer oneth the soul to God. Eunina stepped inside.
And this is it. The room where Julian spent the rest of her life. It's amazing to think of someone being in one room for 30 years. This isn't actually the original, but it is built on the foundations of the 14th century cell that Julian stayed in. In fact, Julian might even be buried underneath here, as a number of anchorites were buried beneath their cells. There'd have been three windows, the first one here, that looked out onto the street. And here, she might have acted almost like an agony aunt, providing counsel to the people who passed by on this very busy road to the port. And here she could provide counsel to everybody from lords and ladies to prostitutes. Then there would have been another window over here that looked out to an alcove. And here Julian would have had a maid, provided her with food and drink, and also removed any waste, so all the nitty-gritty of life. And then there was one more window up here, which looked out into the church. And from here, Julian would be able to watch the service and take part in the daily activities of the church.
Eunina's at the arched window that looks into the main church.
God had spoken directly to Julian. But the problem was, her God was unconditionally loving, caring for all humanity with the tender love of a mother for her children, looking on sinners with pity, not blame. In other words, Julian's God was fundamentally at odds with the views of the church at her time. Given how dangerous some of these ideas were, Julian simply could have kept them to herself. But instead, she took the extraordinary decision to write them down, and to write them down in English, so that everybody could understand them. This is at a time when heretics are being burned for reading the Bible in English. I've written books myself, and anyone who's tried it knows it's an incredibly hard thing to do. But imagine if no woman has done it before you, if you have to learn to read and write in order to do it, and if you're tackling ideas that are potentially life-threatening. Julian must have had great courage and determination. She says, "But just because I am a woman, why must I not write of the goodness of God?" And that is what she did here in this room. For 30 years, she interrogated her revelations, developed her own profound theology, and recorded it all in an incredible book.
These revelations were shown to a simple, uneducated creature in the year of our Lord 1373. On the 8th day of May.
Eunina's gazing up at the leaded windows looking to the outside.
Julian's book describes her vision where the suffering of Christ on the cross and the suffering of humanity are transformed into joy by the enfolding, unconditional, maternal love of a God who is able to make all things well. To understand the full implication of Julian's writing, I'm meeting with Dr. Sarah Sully, reader in medieval literature at King's College London.
So we've been on this journey understanding Julian the woman, but what's so special about the book, The Revelations of Divine Love?
She's the first woman author we have in the English canon, and what a book. You know, what an accomplished and magnificent and sophisticated book that she wrote. Yeah. So it really is a remarkable starting point if you're interested in the history of women's writing.
Julian's seen as a bit of a feminist icon, isn't she? And we don't even need to make that much of a drama about the fact she's a woman. She's just a brilliant writer, isn't she?
She is, absolutely superb. And the directness of the of that address, that opening scene on the deathbed, it's so vivid, so accessible. You're immediately thrown into this the turmoil and the emotions of the sick room. And then you go on this tremendous cosmic journey.
He showed a little thing, the size of a hazelnut, lying in the palm of my hand, and it was round as a ball. I looked at it with my mind's eye and thought, what can this be? And the answer came, it is all that is made.
She makes some quite dramatic statements, doesn't she? Mm. I see no hell.
Yes, I find that fascinating. Yeah. You know, she starts off worrying about the teaching of Holy Church, which she understands to be that non-Christians are damned. And she clearly isn't happy with that. She is not prepared to accept that at some level. But she is very careful to say that nevertheless she doesn't doubt what Holy Church teaches. She does realise that she's potentially on some quite controversial ground here.
I saw truly that our Lord was never angry, nor ever shall be, for he is God. God is the goodness that cannot be angry, for he is nothing but goodness.
She talks about God as mother, doesn't she?
She does. She talks about the motherhood of God, that Christ, in a sense, births humanity in his suffering on the cross, that God is a mother because he nurtures and cares for and disciplines the child, that Christ is a mother because he feeds the child with his blood. And so the Eucharist is then made equivalent to a mother's breastfeeding her child.
I think that she's a very radical writer. I find her very brave, very inspiring.
She is, yes. There is something remarkably fearless in the way in which she pursues her thought. I have been reading this book for 20 years, more, and as I said, it's different every time you read it. It is the kind of book that that lives with you.
Julian had done what no woman had done before. She'd written a book in English, because she was determined to share her vision of an unconditionally loving God. But because her views challenged the church of her time, she was understandably cautious.
Julian died sometime around 1416, at which point only a handful of close friends would have known her text. But this was a dangerous text to have. No hell, a loving God, and written in English by a woman. It's no wonder that the manuscript disappears.
A waterway.
Revelations of divine love was kept secret. The manuscript would most probably have been passed from hand to hand by sympathetic individuals, starting in Norwich and spreading slowly. This is where I turn detective, to find out what happened to Julian's manuscript. Julian lived and died in one room in Norwich, but her words were on the move.
Pilgrimage was big in the medieval period. People would travel across the country by foot, but also by donkey.
Walsingham.
Even women, usually wealthy ones, were able to travel as pilgrims. One female pilgrim we know of was Marjorie Kemp.
Marjorie Kemp, a woman from King's Lynn, was an intrepid pilgrim. She travelled across England, Europe, all the way to the Holy Land. She came here to the Shrine of Mary in Walsingham, but she also visited Julian in her cell just before Julian died.
We know that Marjorie visited Julian because she wrote about it in the Book of Marjorie Kemp, which she dictated to a scribe in 1436. This is the first autobiography in English. Now, where did Marjorie get the idea to write a book? Perhaps Julian entrusted her manuscript to Marjorie, and Marjorie, as she travelled the country, passed it to people sympathetic to Julian's ideas, leaving it in the library of a monastery or private house. Julian's book was a dangerous read, but it was about to get even more dangerous.
Church ruins.
During the Protestant Reformation, the Church of England broke away from the Roman Catholic Church. Monastic life was regarded as ungodly and abolished.
In 1534, Henry VIII, with the help of Thomas Cromwell, passed the Act of Supremacy and began the dissolution of the monasteries, also known as the biggest land grab in history.
Walsingham Abbey was destroyed, and all its possessions were given to the king.
In religious institutions across the country, this process was also taking place, and the manuscripts of the great libraries were either destroyed or sold off.
During the dissolution of the monasteries and the Reformation that followed, a great many religious books were lost forever. Protestants regarded visionary experiences, such as Julian's, with suspicion, and sometimes even denounced them as witchcraft. Julian's manuscript, read by only a few, appeared to be one more casualty of the religious turmoil of the 16th century. But as it turned out, Julian's manuscript had escaped destruction.
Leaving the ruins behind, Janina's driving.
We owe the survival of Julian's book to nine adventurous young women who in 1623 left England to set up a monastery in exile in France, as all monastic life was banned in England. They had a copy of Julian's manuscript. Without them, Julian's writings would have been lost forever.
I'm driving into the heart of the North Yorkshire Moors because there's someone here who can help me pick up the trail of Julian's lost manuscript.
The road leads to a unique building.
Stanbrook Abbey in Wass is the new home of the Order of Benedictine Nuns, first established in France by those nine young English women. This award-winning building is a fitting testimony for the indomitable spirit of the founding sisters and the generations that followed them. I've come to meet Abbess Andrea.
Hello! Welcome to Stanbrook!
So lovely to see you.
To meet you. Come on in.
Thank you.
Now, the nuns are assembling on pale wooden pews for a service in a bright modern chapel. A nun bows in front of the crucifix, then dips her fingers in a blue glass bowl of water. A nun bows at a simple altar. Janina watches as the sisters in the pews straighten up. They're wearing traditional black wimples. One of the younger nuns is in a white garment. The nuns bow, then they make their way out.
Abbess Andrea and Sister Scholastica explain why the nine young women who founded their order play such a vital role in the survival of Julian's text.
So these nine young women, they fascinate me. They're obviously coming from a long tradition of educated women.
I mean, they clearly had vocations. It was a spiritual call. They were searching for God. But it was also an opportunity for them to continue their education, to continue to read, to write, to study.
I mean, this is what I find fascinating as a female academic. Mm. That would have been the life I would have chosen, you know, not the rounds of having babies and being, responsible for the household.
For so many of women who went into religious life, it was their only opportunity to further their education.
What sort of activities are they doing? I mean, obviously they're writing, aren't they? They're engaging with texts.
Mm. They were doing what age-old monasticism has always done. Mm. They were getting hold of manuscripts and copying them.
So am I right in thinking that one of the texts the nuns copied very early on was Julian's Revelations?
Yes, Julian must have been there amongst them.
The nuns were clearly reading Julian because excerpts from her book were being copied out in their personal prayer books in 1649.
This whole manuscript is a collection of writings, meditations, and Julian is part of it. So everything that's in here reflects what they were reading and using for prayer.
And what it shows us then is that this text, Julian's text, is being written, copied and meditated on.
But sadly, the order no longer has Julian's original manuscript.
But your archives, they're not complete, are they?
I mean, we lost absolutely everything at the French Revolution.
We absolutely
lost everything.
The exterior of Stanbrook Abbey.
To discover what happened to the nun's copy of Julian's manuscript, I need to leave England behind and cross the Channel.
From rolling fields to a passenger ferry at sea.
We know that the nine young women who founded the monastery in France had access to Julian's text.
We don't know if they took a copy of the manuscript with them or if it was smuggled out later, but somehow those nuns had a copy of the Revelations of Divine Love.
The young women were from wealthy and high-ranking Catholic families and included Gertrude Moore, the great-granddaughter of Sir Thomas More. Possibly, Julian's text had come from one of their family's libraries. Roman Catholics still valued visionary experiences of the divine, like Julian's. Gertrude Moore was only 17, and the oldest of the group was just 23. They must have been motivated by religion, but perhaps they were also driven by a sense of adventure, by the desire to travel and explore the world. Why would they be any different from young women today? For a woman in the 17th century, life as a nun could give far more freedom and independence than marriage.
The young women had arrived here, in Cambrai. It's now part of northern France, but at the time, it was part of the Spanish Netherlands. I'm here on the Rue des Anglais. It's actually named after the nine Benedictine nuns who set up their convent just down there. There, they were ordained, they lived, they worked, they studied. Their lives would have been very similar, in fact, to that of the nuns at Stanbrook Abbey.
There's very little left of the original monastery, but it is marked on a 17th century map. Throughout the century, the monastery grew as more young women from England joined the founding nine. In 1670, the man who was chaplain to the English nuns in France, Serenus Cressy, published a printed translation of Julian's text based on a handwritten copy made by the nuns. He played down Julian's more challenging ideas. Even so, back in England, the book was vilified as the fanatical revelations of a distempered brain and dismissed. But the English Benedictine nuns in Cambrai continued to treasure and defend Julian's writing. In fact, when their male superiors in the Benedictine order demanded to inspect their library for poisonous material, the nuns refused to hand over their books. Fabienne Laforge, curator at the Municipal Library in Cambrai, has evidence of just how impressive the nuns' library was.
So we've got these wonderful manuscripts. Your store of manuscripts is incredible. So this was in the library of the Cambrai nuns?
Yes, yes.
Brilliant. Oh, look at this! Oh, wow!
This is an English manuscript, and this is this book of Sovereign Medicines. This is a compilation.
Yes.
You have the receipt to fight the plague.
For what? The plague?
Yes.
Oh, my
gosh. Just to fight the plague.
Yeah, this is an antidote against the plague. I wonder if it works.
I never try it.
You haven't tried it? They might have had the answer all along. Gosh, look, so you need saffron, shell, egg whites. Oh, this is it. We've got the key now. We know what to do when next time there's a plague. What a practical book. And it does make you think, doesn't it? If this is coming out of the convent in Cambrai, they're really interested in a variety of things.
Fabienne also has an 18th century catalogue of the nuns' books, made 170 years after the order was founded.
How many manuscripts and books do they list for Combray?
We have 1,000 manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts.
Yes. Wow, so that, again, makes me think this is an active scriptorium, this is a busy library where they're copying text.
Yes, this is one of the clues.
Do we have any evidence then for Julian coming out of
this catalogue? Yes, in the catalogue we have one particular occurrence.
The catalogue shows that the nuns had 15 printed copies of Julian's text, but the original manuscript is not listed. However, some pages of the catalogue are damaged and unreadable.
It lists no manuscripts of Julian.
No known manuscripts.
Oh, so it still could be found.
Yes.
Oh, gotta keep looking for it.
For six generations, the English Benedictine nuns in France had preserved Julian's manuscript, copying the text and defending their right to read it. But the French Revolution was to change all that. The revolutionary government abolished the French monarchy and declared the church an oppressive institution.
For nearly two centuries, the nuns were left to their prayers and their books. But in 1793, a group of revolutionary horse guards turned up here and they told the nuns they had just a quarter of an hour to get their stuff together and get out. They weren't allowed to take boxes or trunks, just a small bundle each, and all their books were confiscated.
The Eiffel Tower.
The Monastery of the English Nuns, including their library of books and manuscripts, was confiscated by the revolutionaries and the nuns were imprisoned. They shared their prison with 16 French Carmelite nuns until one day open wagons arrived to take the French nuns to trial in Paris.
A monument.
I'm here at Place de la Nation in the shadow of Lady Liberty. Just over there, one of the busiest guillotines in the city was set up. Over 50 people a day were being led to their death. And on the 17th of July, 1794, the 16 Carmelite nuns that were imprisoned with the English Benedictines went to the guillotine singing.
The French Carmelite nuns were executed. And the English nuns believed they would go next.
Through a door.
This is a private graveyard, Picpus Cemetery, where the bodies of the French nuns are buried.
A man escorts Janina part of the way, then she opens a gate. She takes in the scene.
Wow. Amazing to think that tucked behind all those other graves, there's this separate section where you've just got two great big squares in the ground designating pits where 1,306 bodies were dumped. And they're referred to as martyrs' graves. Over there, in amongst all the other bones, are the bodies of our Carmelite nuns.
A plaque on a tripod.
The English nuns expected that they too would die. But before they faced the guillotine, the French Revolution ended and the nuns escaped back to England. Unable to wear their habits to travel in, the only clothes they had to wear were those left behind by the murdered French Carmelite nuns. The English nuns returned home, wearing the clothes of their martyred French sisters.
The unique building with a large cross forming part of the facade.
Back at Stanbrook Abbey, Abbess Andrea and Sister Scholastica take me to their private chapel for a rare glimpse of their most treasured holy relics.
This is the reliquary of the Carmelite martyrs. It's the relics that survived, that came back. It's actually some of the clothes that our community wore when they came back from prison.
Really?
Which they realised that the Carmelites had been guillotined, they realised they were martyrs, and they realised just how valuable those clothes were. And later, this beautiful reliquary was made.
This is the actual story. You can see the Carmelites getting into the open wagons, and you can see us looking out the window.
Yes.
So we were looking down onto the sisters as they got into the open wagons that were going to take them to the guillotine.
The guillotine.
And the central picture, obviously, is the guillotine.
Obviously, this is the shrine. Inside, we have the relic.
We're not going to open it.
Removing the finely wrought lid reveals a glass panel with the relics enclosed.
Those are the seals that were put on when it was actually authenticated as being the real relics. There inside you can see a little bit of a shoe. I think it was like an espadrille. And there's some little bits of the material. You can still see the pattern on the material.
Look at that. You can see the colour. It's red and there's a flower there in red and pink.
It's been preserved so well, hasn't it?
I can't believe it.
That's what the Carmelites wore until they went off to the guillotine. That's what our community wore in 1795 when they came back.
Wonderful. Mm.
The nuns were lucky to escape with their lives. For six generations, they had protected and kept alive Julian's book. But now, their original manuscript and all their copies were lost. Or were they? Perhaps somewhere on the continent, a copy of Julian's manuscript made by the English Benedictine nuns was waiting to be discovered. Driving by Buckingham Palace with crowds outside, then other facades, including townhouses. For nearly 500 years, Revelations of Divine Love had been suppressed because it was written by a woman and because it challenged the orthodox views of the church of Julian's own time and of the centuries that followed. But at the beginning of the 20th century, a tide was rising in the sea of history. Throughout the country, women's voices were pressing to be heard.
Women were beginning to experience greater freedom and to demand access to power and education. Oxford University had opened its doors to women, despite the fact that this was widely condemned as unchristian and dangerous.
In 1903, Emmeline Pankhurst founded the Women's Social and Political Union, and their members were the first to be known as the suffragettes. For the first time in history, women were actively campaigning for equality with men.
By now, a woman from a wealthy family had the freedom to study, to write, and to travel.
Outside King's Cross train station.
In 1901, a middle-aged single woman got off the train from Edinburgh and was heading for the British Museum.
Grace Warwick had come to London on a mission. She planned to publish a modern translation of Julian's text.
Hi there, British Library, please. Grace Warwick was from a staunchly Presbyterian Scottish shipowning family, but we really don't know much more about her.
How a Scottish Presbyterian came across the writings of an obscure 14th century English mystic is a complete mystery. Grace is the most unlikely of heroines, but it turns out that she was the right woman at the right time. The woman Julian's text had been waiting for. She wanted Julian's voice to sing out to the world.
The exterior of the British Library.
Grace owned a rare printed copy of Revelations of Divine Love. But this was a 17th century male interpretation of Julian. Grace was looking for Julian's original manuscript, and she had an idea of where to find it.
I'm following in Grace's footsteps, and I've come here to the British Library to see if I can find Julian's manuscript.
At the reading room of the British Library, then part of the British Museum, Grace probably went through the 18th century catalogue of the Hans Sloane collection.
The manuscript section.
Hans Sloane was an extremely wealthy doctor who at his death in 1753 bequeathed his collection of 71,000 objects to the nation.
This formed the basis of the British Museum and included some 50,000 books, manuscripts and prints. The manuscripts were listed by number. No one knows how a copy of Julian's manuscript came into the Sloane collection, but filed in the 18th century catalogue, under the heading Magic and Witchcraft, was the manuscript Grace was after. MS Sloane 2499. Entitled only, Revelations to One Who Could Not Read a Letter, 1373.
The entry highlighted under Magic and Witchcraft.
Gosh, here it is. MS Sloane 2499. This is probably as close as I will ever get to the original manuscript of Julian's Revelations of Divine Love.
Yanina carefully opens the royal blue cover. Sloane MS 2499 is marked at the top of the page. Turning the next page reveals the precious handwritten manuscript.
This is a 17th century copy of a now lost medieval manuscript. It was made by one of the English Benedictine nuns in France.
It's written in an East Anglian dialect and is believed to be the nearest we can get to Julian's original text.
You can almost hear that East Anglian voice coming through. Here's that famous line. Sin is behovable, but all shall be well. All shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well.
She turns another page.
This is the actual manuscript that Grace copied out by hand in the reading room at the British Museum, and it took her just 1 month. I'm surprised at the condition of this. It's really hard to read. The paper's incredibly stained. The ink is biting through from the other side, so it's hard to make out the individual words. I'm amazed that Grace was able to transcribe from this. She then went back up to Edinburgh and translated it into modern English. She managed to persuade Methuen to publish it. And Grace's translation was hugely popular. It's been reprinted multiple times. And thanks to her, the Revelations of Divine Love have never since been out of print.
Because Grace played such an important role in the contemporary recognition of Julian's writing, I went to meet her great-nephew, John Warwick, and his wife, Lucy.
Do you have any memories of her? Do you actually remember her?
I must have been just four. Uh-huh. And we were taken to see Aunt Grace and her elder sister, Rubina, Aunt Bina.
Aunt Bina.
And I just can remember these two old ladies sitting one on each side of the fire in the house. A very, very nice atmosphere of warmth and kindness.
John's grandfather was a wee free Presbyterian, you know, everything very, very fierce. Nobody was allowed to read any books except the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress on a Sunday, that kind of thing. And there she was, plunging into this late medieval Catholic world and producing this brilliant translation and notes and introduction and book and everything about somebody who would think very alien to the atmosphere in which she was living.
She has no training in medieval languages, and yet she wants to go to these mystical texts, these
it's
medieval texts.
It's perfectly possible that in the schoolroom she would have read Chaucer. The move into Julian's kind of English wouldn't have been that difficult.
I've brought a special surprise to show John and Lucy. Grace's handwritten copy of Sloane 2499.
Stanbrook Abbey have very kindly let us have a look at some of the materials they've got from Grace. Look at this!
May I undo it?
Please! Left to the Abbey by Grace. This is it. An amazing discovery. And these are all the notes she made originally while she was translating Julian. This is what was coming off her pen as she was looking at the original manuscript.
This is really going
fascinating. Isn't this wonderful?
Fascinating.
And here she says, this manuscript is said to be in a 17th century handwriting, but that it's coming from the 14th yes. century text.
Here begins the first revelation of the precious crowning of Christ in the first chapter, and how God fulfilleth the heart with most joy.
It's just, I think it's just so wonderful to rediscover her through these texts all this time later, and the more detective work we've done, the more is coming to light.
There are currently over 20 modern English translations of Julian's text available, mostly based, like Grace's, on the Sloane manuscript. But maybe the story of the book is, to use Julian's own words, not yet performed.
Manuscripts turn up all the time, and that's the great excitement of being a medievalist, is that all of a sudden your knowledge about a text can be transformed by a new manuscript that comes to light. Maybe somewhere in a monastic library or a municipal library in France, there is resting an early copy of the long text of Julian.
But thanks to Grace Warwick, Julian now has the reputation she deserves. This stained glass window was made in 2002 for the Chapel Royal at St. James's Palace, the Queen's private chapel. Julian is now acknowledged by both Catholics and Anglicans, and her writing is respected worldwide, translated into every major European language, even Finnish and Catalan. People travel from all over the world to visit her cell in Norwich. Today, St. Julian's Church is hosting a group of pilgrims from North Carolina.
Welcome, welcome properly.
So you've come to see the cell of Julian?
Oh, it's my second time.
Really?
Yeah. This is my first visit to Julian's shrine.
Is it?
And it's beautiful, it's peaceful.
So coming to Julian's cell then, it's helping you to tap into the history, but also her own spiritual view.
Her spiritual view and her view that women did have a place back then, because we think of them as a minor historical footnote, and this is, you know, you could be influential then, you could make a difference.
This has been the most incredible journey, trying to make sense of a text that's had a really profound effect on me. I think for any woman who wants to share their ideas, Julian is the starting point, the inspiration. It's been emotional, exciting, at times excruciating, trying to access this woman who still seems out of reach across the centuries.
He showed a little thing, the size of a hazelnut. I wondered how it could last, for it seemed to me so small that it might have disintegrated suddenly into nothingness. And I was answered, it lasts and always will, because God loves it.
So I've come back to where it all began. The cell that Julian spent her life in and wrote her revolutionary text in. She describes seeing the whole universe in a simple hazelnut. And as I reflect on my experiences, I also feel like they've reached a sense of completion. Julian couldn't leave this cell, but I can. My journey is now complete.
Yanina places the hazelnut she's been holding in a bowl with others, then makes her way out. A richly coloured painting of Julian holding a hazelnut in the palm of her hand.